Let's Talk Development, Season 2, Episode 12.
So I'm delighted to have with us in this CDPR podcast, Dr. Shantha Devarajan. Shantha and I were colleagues at the World Bank for many years. Shantha is now a professor of economics at Georgetown University. Shantha knows South Asia region extremely well. He knows most regions extremely well because he was chief economist in at least two regions that I remember, but probably more. But the most important thing is that Shantha knows South Asia extremely well. He is from Sri Lanka. He has been advising the government on Sri Lanka on the macroeconomic crisis that Sri Lanka experienced 3 years ago, and I think remains engaged with the government in some form or the other. So Shantha, we had a conversation several years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, when we compared Pakistan and Sri Lanka's macroeconomic crises, similarities and differences, about the same time that both countries got into trouble. Pakistan's problem was different in the following sense, that it was a recurrent crisis, whereas Sri Lanka had avoided severe crisis for a while. So please set your own markers as to what the crisis was when we last spoke, and where we think Sri Lanka has reached in addressing the crisis. First, let's talk about stabilization, and then we'll talk about structural reform, which whose objective is to prevent future such crises. So let's talk first about stabilization, what the markers are that you would like to keep in mind as we tell us about progress.
Okay, thanks. And it's a pleasure to be here. Nice to chat with you, Ijaz. I think to start with, let's describe the nature of the crisis in Sri Lanka, which has similarities and differences to Pakistan, I think. I mean, the most important factor was that in April of 2022, Sri Lanka defaulted on its debt. So it called for a moratorium on debt repayment. And the reason for that was that reserves had come down to nearly zero. So it was unable to meet its debt service payments. So in a sense, they had no choice but to stabilize the economy. Now, that just a few comments about how we got to that point. Actually, it goes back about 2 years before that, 2.5 years, which is in late 2019, the newly elected government of Gotabaya Rajapaksa, they cut taxes. So Sri Lanka had the lowest tax to GDP ratio in the world. It was about 8% of GDP. And they didn't cut expenditures so that the fiscal deficit ballooned. And the important thing there was that the credit rating agencies degraded Sri Lanka's credit rating to near default levels, even as early as April 2020. So this was before the COVID pandemic and everything else. Now, usually countries that face that kind of situation, they go to the IMF for a program and they start restructuring their debt. But the Sri Lankan government refused to do either of those things, despite the advice of many people inside and outside the country. Instead, they continue to pay the creditors. And that's what led to the reserve depletion, because they were paying it out of reserves. But they also continued to finance the fiscal deficit, which was about 6 or 7% of GDP, by printing money. And as we know from the textbooks, that leads to inflation, which is in fact what happened. So in 2022, when they declared default, and reserves were down to zero. Not only were reserves down to zero, there were huge shortages of food and fuel and medicines and things like that. But also inflation hit 70%, 7-0, in the third quarter of 2022. So this was the situation that needed stabilization. And as I said, we had no choice. They had to stabilize.
So just one or two clarification questions. One is that, again, unlike Pakistan, Sri Lanka's debt was largely commercial debt. Is that true?
It's about a third. A third was with multilateral institutions. A third was public debt, public in the sense of official bilateral creditors. And a third was from sovereign lenders.
Okay. So still pretty high compared to the commercial debt that Pakistan ran up. In a sense, the expectations of rollover were greater in Pakistan, and therefore it avoided defaulting compared to Sri Lanka.
Right. No, Pakistan has, up to now, as far as I know, avoided defaulting. So, but the other side of that is once you default and you hit this wall with high inflation and shortages, they had to undertake a stabilization program. And I would say, I'll go out on a limb here and say it was about the most orthodox stabilization program you could invent. Basically the central bank raised interest rates. Nominal interest rates went up to the 20s or nearly 30%. Cut some government spending. Increased taxes or replaced some of the lost taxes with increased taxes. And importantly, tried to protect the poor in this transition. I think that was a cornerstone of the program to begin with, was that the country had to tighten its belt. There's no question there was a need for austerity, but let's make sure that austerity is spread a little bit broader, or at least doesn't disproportionately affect the poor and the vulnerable. And so they increased cash transfer programs and things like that at the same time, or replaced fuel subsidies with cash transfers. And the fact is that the program worked. I mean, inflation came down from 70% to 7% in 1 year. I mean, even the IMF was impressed by the progress made. The economy contracted for 2 years. So it contracted about 7% the first year in 2022 and about 3% the second year. But by the third year, it has started to rebound, albeit from a very low base because it had fallen, and there was a combination of the it was mainly the IMF program itself was on track, so reserves actually had exceeded their targets, the foreign exchange reserves. That importantly, and I'll come back to this later about the structural reforms, it actually gave a little bit more breathing room to relax some of the restrictions on imports, which were actually squeezing the economy up that point. Although, again, they had no choice but to do so. And then parallel with that IMF program was the debt restructuring program. Now, that was quite difficult. I mean, it took 2.5 years to actually reach a conclusion, which I gather is nowadays pretty much the norm. But I mean, when you compare it to Zambia, Ghana, and these other countries as well, I would say that one of the reasons for that is that the configuration of creditors has changed quite a bit. So the Sri Lanka's largest bilateral creditor is China.
Yep.
And the traditional approach has been that it was the Paris Club that determined the rules, the format of the debt restructuring. And here was a case where the largest creditor was the largest and the third largest, which was India, were outside the Paris Accord. And quite, I would say, reasonably, the Chinese said, we don't take the Paris Club's rules. We're the biggest creditor, so we will determine the format of the restructuring on its own. Now, this was the problem was made worse, and we'll come back to this later, because of the tensions between the U.S. and China, the geopolitical tensions, which have nothing to do with Sri Lanka, but they still managed to help delay or the progress on the Sri Lankan side. The Chinese didn't want the debt restructuring to be a way of easily repaying the American banks, is the I think their view. The U.S., through its role as the largest shareholder in the IMF, was also suspicious or concerned that this debt restructuring doesn't go towards repaying the Chinese. So as I said, there's this geopolitical scenario that is getting in the way. But anyway, somehow we did manage to overcome that, with some work. And it helped that India played a role as while they're not members of the Paris Club, they were willing to work with the Paris Club in the restructuring. And I think that gave the Chinese a little bit more assurance as well that this was a legitimate process. We've come to an agreement on the debt restructuring. Now,
just one moment. So debt restructuring was a very central part of the stabilization program that was put in place. That was, of course, independent of the standard IMF program.
That's right.
What debt restructuring did was to lower the interest payments that Sri Lanka had to make, and that, in a sense, reduced its external borrowing requirements and made it easier to have the continuation of the IMF program?
Well, it didn't. The debt restructuring it hasn't yet kicked in the sense that Sri Lanka still has not resumed repayment, or I think maybe this spring it's going to resume repayment. But when it does, the amount of repayments will be lower. That's the point.
But to that extent, Sri Lanka will have the fiscal space to do sensible public investments to get growth going again.
Right. Again, in principle. I mean, if you look at the actual numbers, it's not so reassuring. I mean, the debt restructuring brought the debt-to-GDP ratio from 125% to 95%. So after restructuring, we're at 95% of GDP. That's not a lot of fiscal... Yeah, that's not a lot of fiscal space.
In Pakistan, it's a lot lower, so it's
right. The revenue to GDP ratio has been inching up. It I think it's about 11% now GDP. So that does provide some breathing room. But I mean, if I think the critical aspect of the growth rebound or the structural reforms in order to both, as you say, avoid another debt default, but also to be able to resume growth. Because incidentally, Sri Lanka has had the proverbial lost decade now.
Yes.
GDP per capita is the same as it was 10 years ago.
But Shanta, given the civil war, I think Sri Lanka has had four decades, lost decades. And not just the last one.
Well, let's discuss that. If you want to talk about the long term, just keep in mind that during the Sri Lankan civil war, the 26-year civil war, the per capita GDP growth rate was 3% a year.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
I don't call that a lost decade. Sri Lanka's done amazingly well.
We talk about that. Yeah. My expectation when I started visiting Sri Lanka after serving in East Asia was that Sri Lanka should really be like an East Asian tiger. And compared to that, it's a lost decade. But anyway, we'll come back.
We'll get back to that. I would say Sri Lanka is a South Asian tiger. But just to finish on the structural reforms and the resumption of growth and everything else, the key is, as in many of our countries, is governance. The reason we got into this mess in the first place was bad governance. There's no question. I mean, the tax cuts, the refusal to go to the IMF, the refusal to undertake a debt restructuring was all due to corruption and bad governance. And so the question is, yeah, you've stabilized the economy. What have you done to actually improve governance? Now, I'd say probably the most important thing that Sri Lanka has done is that in 2023, they introduced a Central Bank Act that actually enshrines in the Constitution now the independence of the central bank. So the reason for the high inflation was that we didn't have an independent central bank. The Ministry of Finance dictated what the central bank would do or the monetary policy. And now, in the Central Bank Act, it is forbidden for the central bank to finance fiscal deficit. It's as simple as that. And it passed through Parliament. It was a struggle. There was, quite rightly, there were a lot of opposition about it, and the people are still upset about it. But I think that's the kind of changes that give me some confidence that we've reversed or dampened this corrosive effect of bad governance on the country. Let me just mention one other thing, which I'm very pleased with because I had something to do with it, is that as part of the debt restructuring, we've introduced something called a governance-linked bond. So one of the instruments in the debt restructuring, one of the new bonds, is this governance-linked bond, which has a couple of governance-related criteria. And if the government undertakes those measures that are in the criteria, the interest rate goes down. Now, if they don't take those measures, the interest rate does not go up. It stays the same. So it's a one-sided risk for the government. But the beauty of this is that then it makes governance reforms fiscally attractive.
Yeah.
And that helps because as you know, in most governments, you might have a head of state or you might have a finance minister who wants to undertake these governance reforms, but there's a lot of resistance from the parliament or from other line ministries and so on. And here they're able to say, yeah, you know, we should do these reforms, not just because they're good things and they'll prevent the rent seeking and they'll reduce the amount of corruption, but they're also good for us, for our budget. They actually help save on our interest payments. And so this is a new instrument. And interestingly, it was proposed by the creditors, by the private creditors, but accepted by both sides.
So I think the two reforms together, an independent central bank that will not allow the government to print money, and a governance-linked bond that makes it attractive cross limits on how much to make it attractive for the government to actually improve fiscal outcomes results in the two together make it very attractive for the government to reform governance to be able to spend money better, etc. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And What did you have to do with this idea?
Oh, I think a guy in Sri Lanka, Nishan Dumel, and I actually invented it. we started it. We actually made a proposal, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago now, both to the government and to the creditors and to the IMF, wrote up the design. And it's interesting because both the government and the IMF were skeptical. And it was thankfully one of the creditors, the groups that actually picked up on it, even though they were the ones who would likely, well, on the one hand, they're the ones absorbing the risk of the bond. But they pushed ahead with it. And then finally, they elaborated on it. And then when they finally proposed it, the government couldn't say no because it was a win-win for them.
And what were the markers of governance improvement?
They weren't that drastic, I would say. There were things like publishing public procurement contracts over a billion rupees or something like that. So making it transparent, all public procurement contracts. And the second was actually to keep to the fiscal responsibility targets.
Okay. No, both of those make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
We are beginning to toy with the idea of a sovereign wealth fund, which is where state-owned enterprises can be parked. And this sovereign wealth fund can then be, in a sense, traded. And its rating improves as the state-owned enterprise performance improves. That enables the government to attract funds. So we're still very early stages of thinking about that. And we will drag you into that conversation. Sharing this Sri Lanka experience, Shatha. My question to you is, Sri Lanka saw a major shift in terms of the political party that came to power. It had a very left-leaning profile. So the question is, were reform disrupted as a result of that change?
No, not at all. I would say they came into the election campaign with a lot of rhetoric, saying we're going to renegotiate the IMF agreement and abandon it, essentially. But even during the campaign, there were quite a few dialogues going on. And in fact, I participated in some of them where I was just trying to sort of explain to them what the logic of the IMF program was and why we needed to keep it. And even before the election, they started changing their tune. They actually, the president, Anurakumara Dissanayake, when he was a candidate, actually made statements saying, like, we are not going to change the IMF program. We just want to make adjustments that will help the poor. So that was exactly the right way to look at it, which is you want to keep the overall targets the same, the fiscal surplus and so on. But if there are things you can do to protect the poor better, we should do them.
And Sri Lanka has fairly good, well-targeted programs to support the poor.
Although, no, that's compared to what, right?
My memory is from the times that I worked on Sri Lanka in the, I'd say, 2005-06, around that time.
You remember Samurdhi, the cash transfer program, right? Samurdhi, 50% of the people receiving Samurdhi are not poor, and 50% of the poor don't receive Samurdhi.
Okay.
I don't call that well targeted. Was
that always the case, or did it deteriorate?
That was the case when you were working on it.
Okay.
It's gotten a little better. It's like about 30 to 40% now. But the reason for it is that, like a lot of others, this program has been politically captured. You can see that it's directly related to the people who get Samurdhi are is coincidentally associated with the ruling party. And the people who don't are the ones who aren't connected to the ruling party. So we've tried to change it. Now there's a new program. It's not called Samurdhi anymore. It's Aswasuma, that is based on more objective criteria, and introduced electronic transfer of the funds and things like that. So we're getting there, but it's not a slam dunk. Just like in other places.
So the reduction of untargeted subsidies, which is an important part of the IMF program, is something that this left-leaning government was quite happy to work with.
Yeah, not quite happy, but they have worked on it. And in fact, the budget that they just released about a month ago is a fairly orthodox budget, I would say. That includes reform of fuel subsidies and electricity subsidies. And importantly, and maybe we should come back to this, includes further relaxation of trade restrictions. So they are actually trying to promote trade. And because they realize, like everybody else, import restrictions are the things that impede exports. And so if you want to export, you have to relax import restrictions.
Now, again, if my memory serves me well, Sri Lanka was the most open economy in South Asia.
That's right. And it still is. It still is relative to other South Asian countries. But that may be a statement about the state of the rest of South Asia. And it was one of the first. See, in 1978, they liberalized trade. This is, around the same time as Chile and long before the other South Asian countries. And the place just boomed. I mean, it was an amazing success story. The GDP growth rate doubled over that period. There was all the usual concerns about trade liberalization. I remember, I was too young to remember, but I have gone back and read about it. They had a domestic garment industry. And they said, with these cheap imports coming in, the garment industry is going to collapse. On the contrary, the garment industry boomed.
Yes.
And Sri Lanka's garment exports per capita were higher than Bangladesh through the 1990s.
Right. Now, Pakistan's experience was similar. In the late 1990s, Pakistan did a substantial reform of customs duties.
Right.
We had export growth of 12% or more per annum for several years, right. and then the whole custom duty reform was completely reversed.
Right.
When in Musharraf's government they ran into fiscal difficulties and started imposing all kinds of para tariffs,
right,
to raise revenues. And the result is that Pakistan, with the highest GDP to export to GDP ratio till the 1990s, is now the lowest export to GDP ratio compared to...
And this happened in Sri Lanka too. I mean, the first Rajapaksa government, I mean, since Mahinda Rajapaksa was elected in 2005, the trade ratio, the sum of exports plus imports to GDP, has been declining. It's gone from 40% to 20%. With increased trade restrictions. And growth has slowed down. I mean, that spectacular growth they had through the mid-90s, through the 2000s, is no more.
Right. So, the popular perception about the IMF programs is that it is anti-poor, that it, right, it hurts the poor. Your experience in Sri Lanka, as well as the experience here, is that the IMF has been a very strong supporter of the Benazir Income Support Program
of course,
Pakistan, a program that works well and has always tried to protect it in the way the program is structured. So I think that perception that it is an anti-poor program is something that we need to think about.
I've been thinking. I hear this in Sri Lanka all the time, and the fact nobody looks at the counterfactual.
Yes.
The poor will be much worse off without the IMF program. They will be devastated, right? So that's one thing. But the other is it's a question of the coincidence. You know, the analogy I draw is like, if you have a fire in your house, you call in the fire brigade and they come in and they're trying to put out the fire. And in order to put out the fire, they might break some windows and doors in your house. But you don't blame the firemen. They're actually trying to help you.
Right.
But in order to do it, you have to, somebody has to take a hit. And that's what these programs are. There has to be an austerity. There has to be a reduction in absorption in the economy. But you don't necessarily associate that. You shouldn't necessarily blame the IMF for that. On the contrary, they're trying to find a way to do the austerity in such a way that protects the poor.
Right. Now, of course, in the case of Pakistan, the situation is slightly different in the following sense that, you know, if you have an IMF program once in a while because you've had a major external shock or you messed up your things yourself, then that's fine. You go through a period of austerity, you do the structural reform, you fix your economy, and you move forward. But in our case, we've had IMF programs one after the other for the last 20 years. Now, we do have a curtailment of growth in the IMF programs. And Pakistan's growth has never really recovered to levels that it was before it got into the first IMF program, you know, after the millennial, after 2000. And therefore, there is some criticism here that the program is not designed for countries like Pakistan because the program will not allow growth to resume. So there's that criticism.
But again, but that's the same. Yeah, I mean, that suffers from the same flaw, right? I mean, if you had growth, you wouldn't need an IMF program. It's not that the IMF program is curtailing growth. It's actually trying to stabilize the economy so that it can actually start growing.
Right.
I know from the Sri Lankan experience, the reason we don't get the growth going is that usually the IMF program goes off track or it's canceled. And so then you haven't solved the original problem we set out to solve. So then you can't get the growth to resume.
And that's what happened in Pakistan. I mean, we stabilized and then we went back to the bad old ways because there was an election.
There's an election, right?
Okay. So in terms of structural reform, what you're saying that on the fiscal front, there is good progress. And on the trade front, also, there is good progress.
The trade front, there is progress. But there has to be more. I think they have to be even more aggressive on trade liberalization. Because like you were suggesting in Pakistan, there are a whole bunch of non-tariff barriers and paratariffs that have been introduced that are standing in the way of export growth. It's frustrating to me because Sri Lanka is your textbook case of when trade liberalization actually works.
Yes.
And it gets back to something you alluded to, which is the reason the situation boomed in the 1980s and 90s through the 2000s was this high level of human capital.
Exactly.
That they had, right? So when you liberalize trade, you had an educated and healthy population who could take advantage of it.
Exactly, exactly. So here's why I thought Sri Lanka would be like an East Asian tiger in South Asia, of course, because you had investment in human capital. You had you were liberalizing. There was trade liberalization. And Sri Lanka was always popular with the rich countries in terms of tourism, in terms of, you know, transfer of funds whenever Sri Lanka got into trouble. So I thought this was an ideal combination that would result in Sri Lanka tapping into world markets to experience sustained growth for a long period of time despite being a relatively small economy, you know, just like Malaysia or Hong Kong or Taiwan or Chile, etc. Relatively small economies, but having the workforce that can produce for the larger global economy, and therefore that's the path to development. And I always felt that Sri Lanka would be on that path, and I felt that the civil war got in the way earlier, and of course mismanagement got in the way later.
Yeah, but I've gone back and looked at this a bit, and I think we have to be careful that while Sri Lanka showed good progress in this area, there were some deep underlying pathologies and the civil war, of course, you know, the civil war itself didn't just happen by accident. There was a tension between Tamils and Sinhalese in the country, and so that's one of the pathologies. But I think there's also this is a hypothesis I've been working on. Because Sri Lanka was showing so much progress, it masked some underlying pathologies, one of which is that there was still a deep confidence that government knew better than the people how to manage the economy. The sort of arrogance, I would say, you can still run a statist policy. And that actually is what leads to this resistance to trade liberalization and privatization and a reform of subsidies and things like that. And the truth is, government cannot know better than the people what's good for them. And certainly their incentives to do what's good for the people are limited when there's so much capture, elite capture. So even the education system, you know, which is a free public education system that is delivered in terms of enrollments, secondary school enrollments, and so on, is still falling short on quality, as it is in many other countries. And learning outcomes are still very poor. And the whole higher education system is a disaster because, again, they refuse to have private universities. It's against the law. And there's huge resistance whenever somebody tries to set up a medical school or business school or something like that. And as a result, you know, Sri Lanka's enrollment, the secondary school enrollment is the highest in South Asia, and the tertiary school enrollment, tertiary enrollment, is the South Asian average.
I didn't know that it was illegal to open private universities.
Yeah, so I mean, people find ways around it by calling it not a university but a training institute or something like that. But you can't have a regular private university in the country, and there are none. And that's why most of the students go abroad, probably to Pakistan, among other places.
Private universities in Pakistan have really made a difference. Well, again, not all. We have to be careful. I mean,
there's a variation in quality.
There's a variation, but some private universities have really set very high standards, which is great. I have to ask you this question.
Yeah.
The U.S. Forget the role the U.S. played in the concessionary capital pool of funds. Let's ignore that. But United States was a major player in terms of ideas about growth, about a global structures of the economy, the need to be to have stable global structures, the need for trade to flow. Etc. You know, the U.S. was a thought leader in all of this, and now it seems that the Americans have handed over most levers of power to a person and a team of people who advise him, who want to reverse all this at speeds unheard of. I mean, the U.S. is a large ship, and they're going to turn it around in minuscule time. So where are we headed?
Okay, so I, the what's going on, what the U.S. is doing now is just completely crazy. But the main thing damage it's going to do is to the U.S. itself.
Yes.
They're shooting themselves in the foot big time. And so that's the main thing. What can we do? What can the developing world do in this scenario? And that's where it gets interesting, because certainly they can't do anything to influence what the U.S. does. They're not going to listen to us. But the question I've been asking is there something that we can do in terms of our own policies that leads the situation better than what it would be if we didn't do those things? And I think there is an answer there. Because I did some analysis during the last Trump administration when there was a trade war between the U.S. and China. And I asked the question, you know, what's the best response for a developing country if there's a trade war between the U.S. and China? And the answer is basically, the one-line answer is turn the other cheek. That is, the best thing a developing country can do is to liberalize its trade regime while the U.S. and China are fighting a trade war, because that's when you can maximize the trade diversion opportunities.
Yes.
Right. And we saw that, right? I mean, the Brazilians started selling soybeans to China when the U.S. Couldn't do it anymore. And they made money out of it. So I think all the things we've been talking about before about increasing openness to trade, we should accelerate that in light of the trade war. Take advantage of it.
Yeah. Let me cite you a story told to me by ready-made garments exporters from Pakistan. This is last week. They said that they were in the United States on some exhibition where they had their own section where they were displaying what Pakistan can export. And he said, we have never seen such footfall in our section of the exhibition room as this time, because of the tariff wars going on between China and United States. There's a lot of interest in coming to us because you're not out of that war.
That's so right. It's best to stay out of it and exploit it for what it's worth.
Thank you very much.